We've talked extensively and intensively about, you know, some of Maimonides, what do we call it, philosophical anthropology. You know, about, we talked about philosophical anthropology, his embrace of, you know, strenuous seeking, a desire for excellence, and a shame, a human mediocrity and embodiedness. And then we've talked a lot about the strong medicine he takes vis-a-vis the tradition, right? And what I mean by that, you know, willingness to take certain mockery, to take very radical steps about how we know what we know, and the Torah, and how that shapes how we read the Torah, and looked at that kind of dialogue across centuries between him and Spinoza. But I want to do something somewhat different today, which is we're going to look at three passages from the Mishnah Torah, which we've looked at almost not at all, looking at the guide and the Mishnah commentary. We're going to actually just, I hope, get to really kind of see and feel our way through Maimonides as a reader and writer of the tradition. So these aren't going to be explicitly methodological, if that makes sense. He's going to be talking about issues of theology, of social conflict, of loneliness, of ethics, of ethnic boundaries, et cetera. But not just saying, hey, I'm doing this now. We're just going to see him do it, if that makes sense. Also, for these sources, since it's a little bit, they're a little bit less self-explanatory early stages, because we're going to be kind of looking at some biblical sources and then seeing what Maimonides makes of them. I'm going to do more of the reading than I normally have, just because there's a lot of like reading and explanation. I'm going to do some paraphrasing also, because some of these sources, we're going to read them only kind of primarily to look at how Maimonides, what he makes of them. Okay, so the first thing is, what does it mean to be a Levite? Okay, this is like a fairly innocuous question. I mean, he descended from the tribe of Levi. Done it. Okay, this is source number two. But it turns out that that means different things in different accounts. So what I want you to see is, at first, is how we have two, at least two, Maimonides is going to show us a third, accounts of who and what the Levites are. And this is very interesting. So here is our first account of Levitical election, I will call it. Something that's important but a bit strange about Levites, you know, is that is the most common way, but not necessarily the most accurate way, to think about Levitical election is that there are three concentric circles or more concentric circles of Israelite status, right? What I mean by that is you have the Israelites, within them you have the Levites, the tribe of Levi, within them you have the Kohanim, the descendants of Aaron, right? Boom, and then actually within them you have the line of the high priest. That is not the only way that they are conceived in the Bible. For those of you, I feel like throwing out some source criticism, we like the least heretical thing we've done this time, right? So in Deuteronomy, there is no distinction between Levites and Kohanim, right? It'll always say Halevim HaKohanim, if you look close, which means the Levites who are the priests, right? Because Kohen is actually a term of function. Yitro is Kohen Midyan. Malki Tzedek is Kohen Le'el Elyon, right? The priest of the exalted God. Kohen is right in function. And similarly, and this is actually probably the most interesting, there in Deuteronomy, there is no function of a Kohen, right? So for example, for the laws of the accidental murderer, as we have them in Numbers, the accidental murderers can leave their city of refuge on the death of the Kohen Gadol. That is not part of the laws of the accidental murder as they're presented in Deuteronomy, because there is no Kohen Gadol, according to Deuteronomy. Now, if you really want to have some fun, you could think about the ways that the story of Korach is actually a fight between the priestly source and the Deuteronomic source. Right? Korach's complaint, why have you set yourselves up as an elite class? The whole group is holy. Korach, coming from the tribe of Levi, is representing Deuteronomy, right? And Moshe and Aharon are representing actually a priestly version where there is a second level of hierarchy. So we have these different accounts of Levitical election, and the stakes here, right, if there are no, if the Levites are co-equal with the Kohanim, then that's even higher stakes. Okay, so now, Andrew, if you could turn the screen on, we just have laid the groundwork a little bit better in terms of the conceptual. Okay, so the first one here, Exodus 32, Parashat Ki Tisa, also known as the golden calf. Bad scene, right? The people get the Ten Commandments. Moshe's up on the mountain. They get stressed out. Aharon helps them make an idol, which they proclaim as their God. So then afterwards, I'll just summarize, right? Moshe calls, says, right, Mi Lashem Eli, whoever is for God, come to me. Who is the pure group who has not only not worshipped idols, but is willing and ready to wreak vengeance on those who did. We don't go there anymore. This is perfect. And the tribe of Levi comes to him, right? In verse 28, the Levites did as Moses had bidden, and some 3,000 people fell on that day. They slayed them. Moses, dedicate yourselves, or really you have dedicated yourselves today to God, for each of you has been against his son and brother. It seems like even if it's only a subset of Levi or the son and brother, broadly here to include fellow Israelites, that he, God, or it, may bestow a blessing upon you today. This is the first account we have of a distinctive religious character in charge to the tribe of Levi. And so here the account is some kind of religious exemplariness. And in Michael Walzer's book, Exodus and Revolution, which is strange as a piece of political history, but excellent as a reading of the book of Exodus, Walzer does something really lovely here, where he points out that a very helpful analog to this passage is the Leninist theory of vanguard. Right? Lenin had a theory of Marxist revolution that at a certain stage of the revolution, the great opposition to its success comes not from external forces of the bourgeoisie, or entrenched sites of power, like the church perhaps, but actually the ideological corruption of the proletariat by them carrying around kind of type of slave mentality. And what you need is an ideologically pure vanguard to purge the gulag, basically. So Walzer points out that the Levites here function as the Leninist vanguard. That's beautiful reading. In purging the people, right, who are now the greatest threat to their own liberation. The Egyptians are gone. Pharaoh is gone. You know, any impositions on the outside are gone. It's the consciousness of the people that represents the greatest obstacle to their reformation and liberation and redemption. And so they need to be purged, right? Perfect. Okay, so this is account number one. The Levites are religiously in this moment in history when they stood up against idolatry, for the worship of God. Okay, that's account one. Great. Now scroll down, Andrew, because we have a second account. Okay, here it is again, very short. Right, the Lord spoke, or we used to say spake, to Moshe, saying, right, hereby take the Levites from among Israel in place of all the firstborn. Verse 13, for every firstborn is mine. At the time that I smote every firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated every firstborn in Israel, man and beast, to myself to be mine, the Lord's. So there's actually two steps of indirection, they call it in computer science, at work here, right? So God struck the Egyptian firstborn, and in that moment, God acquired all of the Israelite firstborn. Right? The first fruits belong to the Lord. So the Israelite firstborn are acquired kind of through their relationship to the Egyptian firstborn. We talked about the Egyptian firstborn last night, yesterday. And then the Levites stand in for the Israelite firstborn, the second degree removed. And you can actually see, if you look at this passage at the beginning of the Midbar, there's actually a census of there are X number of Israelite firstborn, and there's a slightly differing number of Levites, and then that has to be accounted for. So here, right, the reference is to a different stage of Israel. The election of the Levites kind of occurs in some sense later, because we're in the Midbar, not in Shemot. But it also occurred earlier because it's in reference to an event in Egypt. And here it's not their agency, really. This is actually all about birth order, if that makes sense. Who are the Egyptian firstborn? Who are the Israelite firstborn? Who the tribe of Levi stands in because of their being birthed together. They didn't necessarily do anything to earn that distinction. It's not because of anything they did. It's divine, you know, fiat, choice, grace, etc. And these two accounts are not totally compatible. You could harmonize if you wanted to. But what would be the fun of harmonizing, right? So I wanted to suggest there's these two different kinds of accounts of, on some level, what it means to be a Jew, right? What does that mean, right? In this account that we just read here, you are born into a story, right? And you carry it on. Egyptian firstborn, remember that we're taken out of Egypt. We have markers and reminders of that. And you carry that on. And then there's another account that you stand up against idolatry. And what do you mean, Phyllis? What do you mean, and beast?
It says, I consecrated every firstborn in Israel, man and beast, to myself to be mine, the Lord's.
Yes. Oh, it's a good and beast. You know, Beauty and the Beast. This is like being my man, humans and animals, but really not. Beast is a domesticated animal, really more precisely, because the firstborn animals also belong to God. Or as they say more precisely than philosophical, firstborn non-human animals. The way that the philosophers here like to talk about their human animals and non-human animals. So those also, and that's, you know, laid out many passages in the Torah about how they're treated. They can't be sacrificed, if they are separated from their mothers, etc. So now we have an account of the Israelites. So we're in Devarim, standing on the, you know, threshold of the land of Israel, telling the story of how we got there. And so Moshe's account here from Be'erot B'nei Akan, the Israelites marched to Moserah. Aharon died there and was buried there, and his son Eleazar became priest in his place. From there they marched to Gudgod, and from Gudgod to Yotvat, a region of running brooks. At that time, the Lord set apart, you'll see why I bolded these in a minute, because Maimonides will quote these. At that time, the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the Ark of the Lord's covenant to stand before the Lord, to serve the Lord, and to bless in his name, as is still the case in its name. See? That is why the Levites have received no portion, chilek, along with their kinsmen. The Lord is their inheritance, Hashem, collection, as the Lord your God spoke concerning them. Okay. So this is a story about the Levites and how they became the Levites. And the first thing is that it happens at a time where nothing's happening in a place that perhaps doesn't have a name, right? In verse 7, from there they marched to Gudgod, and from Gudgod to Yotvat, a region of running brooks. At that time, was it in Gudgod? Was it in Yotvat? Was it in between when they were marching? We don't really know. It's a dilated moment in an unspecific place where nothing of significance is happening. There's no smiting of the firstborn. There's no sin of the golden calf, of apostasy, and divine rage as a result. And the picture here seems to be that the marker of that, the ongoing consequence of this type of Levitical election, is that they never fully settle in the land of Israel, Palestine on the other side, right? They stand before the Lord, they serve the Lord, and they receive no portion among their kinsmen because the Lord is their inheritance. I.e., on this account, what it means to be a Levite is to be marked in a moment of wandering, to be selected in a placeless location, and to remain placeless even as the rest of the Israelites settle, and to bear a memory of that placelessness forever. Right here, maybe another way of describing it, unlike the golden calf, where the alternative to God is an idol, quite strikingly, the alternative to God is having a portion of land. They don't have a portion of land, they have God. Now, what does that say about the rest of the Jewish people? Really interesting question, right? They have, why do they get land instead of God? What does that mean that those are the two options? Fascinating, right? They actually preserve a diasporic life. So now watch what my mind says. So I hope you notice these broad, bold things, right? Got set apart to stand before the Lord. They have no portion. The Lord is their inheritance. Right, the inheritors of post-temple life, right? For them, actually, I want to point out, for the Levites, the entry into the land, and in some sense, the exile on land, is an event of, I don't want to say no significance, but marginal significance. I'll give you a parallel. This is like a really interesting parallel. One of my good friends is from a Turkish Jewish family. And he says, yeah, you know, look, we lived in Istanbul. we didn't really run the government. But we could travel to Jerusalem without a passport. And now we live in Holon. Our party that we vote for is in the opposition. And we can travel to Jerusalem without a passport. Not that much has changed. Now, obviously, a lot has changed, and he's saying that to be in the nick, but it's actually a really interesting picture of, like, well, for his family's narrative, there's a lot of continuity. They've had access to Jerusalem for hundreds of years. Not this radical break in 48, and some significant things changed, but there's actually a great deal of continuity. So we're here in the end of Shemitah Yovel. Just think, really interesting to know about the Rambam is oftentimes it's at the end of a section of the Mishnah Torah, a section of Halachot, where he says something really interesting. So there is a mitzvah, right, in the Torah, in Parshat Vayikra, lo tikom velo titor. Do not take vengeance and do not bear a grudge. These are interpreted in the Talmud behaviorally. Taking vengeance is the paradigmatic example, as if I need to borrow Robert's shovel. He's going to go over, knock on his door on a Sunday morning, Robert, can I borrow your shovel? And he says, no. Even though I know he has a shovel. I'm annoyed. The next week, he needs to borrow my chainsaw. And he comes over and says, Jason, can I borrow your chainsaw? And I say, no, because you didn't let me borrow your shovel last week. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to say, sure. Here's my chainsaw. Not bearing a grudge, you know, the Talmud likes to kind of play out these doublings, which are kind of synonymous in biblical, you know, poetic expression. So what does not bearing a grudge mean? So week one, Sunday number one, the, you know, sixth of the month, I come over to Robert and say, can I borrow your shovel? He says, no. Sunday the 13th, he comes over, Jason, can I borrow your chainsaw? I say, yeah, because I'm a better person than you. So I'm not going to treat you like you did me last Sunday. Take the chainsaw. That's what people often mistakenly call passive aggressive. It's just aggressive, right? Did we talk about this with Maimonides? I'm trying to remember. A few weeks back? Okay, great. So that's as far as the Talmud goes. So Maimonides codifies this. This is the very end of Hilchot Deot. And then he says something interesting. This is a behavioral norm. Think, don't be an asshole. So Maimonides says something interesting. He says, the problem is this behavioral norm doesn't go far enough. Because as long as you remember the bad thing Robert did to you, it's going to slip out one way or another. So the mitzvah of not bearing a grudge is not a behavioral one. It's actually a cognitive one. You're commanded to forget what Robert did, because if you have a long enough memory, you'll hate everyone. And that's no way to live. And then he does something really interesting. He says the commandment to forget is a commandment that applies within the horizons, within the boundaries of the covenantal community of the Jewish people. Maybe even it marks those boundaries. Don't forget what everyone did, but you forget that the people that you're committed to living with did. So I think about this obviously a lot in terms of Israel-Palestine stuff, really interesting. I also think about it a lot nowadays in terms of the work the Jewish community is doing to forget, you know, anti-Semitic horrors and Ukrainian nationalism in the early part of the 20th century. I just think up to 200,000 Jews were massacred. You know, it's south of Slava Ukraini, right? Tel Aviv in May, leading a birthright trip at the super hip coffee shop. And the barista with these beautiful green eyes greets me. It's Slava Ukraini. A wild moment. maybe we should forget what the Ukrainians did as their tribe, right? So anyway, so my mind includes really interesting things like that, often at the end of sections of the Mishnah Torah. So the Mishnah Torah is 14 books. That's why it's called the Yad HaChazaka Yud Dalet for 14. And the seventh of those books, I'm sorry, the seventh section exactly, of the seventh of those books is the Laws of Shemitah and Jubilee. Amazing. This has all been about the land, Shemitah and Yovel. So Maimonides asks, why were the Levites not apportioned part of the land of Israel or a share of its spoils along with their brethren? Now I want to point out, right, the first two accounts don't really say anything about that, right? The account from Exodus, the golden calf, the account from Bamidbar about being the firstborn. But this one does. Watch this. Because they were separated, worship the Lord and to serve God. Huvdal Isharta, which are both from that third account, words that show up in the third account in Deuteronomy of the wandering and not in either of the first two accounts. To teach God's upright ways. Now, upright is not a word that we've seen, but I've underlined it because we're going to see it somewhere else.
and just laws to everyone, as it is written, they shall teach your laws to Jacob, your instruction to Israel. That's from Moses' blessing to the tribe of Levi upon his death. For this reason, they were separated, huftalu, from worldly affairs. They fought no battles like the rest of Israel. They inherited no land. They won nothing by means of their physical strength. God, may God be blessed, has taken them for God, as it is written. And God said to Aaron, you will not inherit the land. You'll have no portion among them. I am your portion and your share. Right? I mean, this language, again, scroll down just a little bit, the language, again, of Nachalah and Chilek. And interestingly, you see what the Rambam does here is he's taking something that was said to Aharon and applying it to all of the tribe of Levi, right? Just like we talked about earlier. Now watch. So that is, so Maimonides, you can see here, it started to signal that he's really interested in this third account of the tribe of Levi. He's privileging it over the other two, that there's a sense of placelessness, even of disembodiment, which characterizes the spiritual meaning of being a Levite, right? Not only the tribe of Levi, but each and every human being whose spirit moves her and whose mind guides her to set herself apart. Again, lehibadel, the separateness, to stand before the Lord to serve God, la'amod lifnei Hashem u'lishaarto, and worship God, to know the Lord, who walks, and then we have this other passage, where did this come from? We'll see in a second. Who walks uprightly as God made him, casting from his neck the yoke of the many reckonings that people seek. What's that? You'll see. Is indeed divinely consecrated. Lord will be their portion and inheritance. Chalkov and Achaleto, just like we had before about Abraham. God will provide sufficiently for his needs as he, it should be it did for the priests, capital I, and the Levites. David, may he rest in peace, declare the Lord is my allotted portion, my cup, you uphold my portion. So what the Rambam has just done is he said the Levites, and this, you know, you could go a long ways towards Paul if you wanted to here, right? The Levites are a metaphor. They're a real group of people with real halachot, and they also hold out a spiritual possibility. Is this Paul? Is this Origen? I don't know my language, right? There's Israel of the flesh and Israel of the spirit, right? There's an idea that, and this is the Maimonidean claim that there are Levites of the flesh and Levites of the spirit. And the essence of that is to be nomadic, to be alienated from society. And we see actually David has this status, although he is from Shevet Yehuda, from the tribe of Judah, not a Levite, right? But Maimonides accords him this status here. how do I think Maimonides is related to the Hebrew? And so that's actually why I use, whenever I'm translating, certainly Maimonides, and often other passages, I'm speaking Maimonides, I will translate the divine pronouns as it, capital I, which I think is the correct Maimonidean rendering. I don't think it's actually the correct rendering of who Hashem is. Beyond all the pronouns, but I think that's the only Maimonideanly defensible one. God is certainly non-binary. Now watch this. Scroll down just a little bit. That bold section, that underlined section, I'm sorry, comes from one other place. Oh, there we go. There we go. Ecclesiastes 7:29. Except or additionally, see, I found this. It should be really additionally. God made people upright, but they sought many reckonings. Chishvonot, which is a strange word, and Maimonides uses it here. Actually, the Aria edition, at least when I prepared this source sheet, originally mispointed Chishvonot as Cheshvonot because the person who did the dots in Maimonides didn't recognize that it was a quote from here. So here, this is wisdom, right? God made humanity upright. This is kind of like Rousseau, right? An original human being, an uncultured human being is a proud one, a beautiful creature. But culture and fads, politics and status, et cetera, draw us away from who we really are. We seek many reckonings, or as my mind is called, the vanities of the time have lay hasman. And so this is, you know, in some ways compatible with the first account of the Levites, the ones who can resist, you know, the temptation of idolatry. But I think there's a critical difference also, which is that, you know, the picture of the Levites in Golden Calf is people who are at war with their surroundings. Whereas here, you know, we have a picture in Devarim, this is wandering. People are just alienated from people, are separate from people, are never at home and their surroundings. I'm just passing through, kind of bohemian, you might say. And that is very much the path of the Levites of the Spirit, whom Maimonides lays out here and holds up as a spiritual example. And part of what's very striking, right, and this is a nice Maimonidean paradox. I mean, nice is a really limp word to use here. Right, this is a picture of where human nature is good and tradition is bad. I'm sorry, tradition, culture, those akin books, ideas, maybe even words, you know, or at least literature are bad. Right, those are the things, you know, you have to set your face against those things. You resist them. You don't get drawn on by them. You go against the current. But Maimonides also wrote a lot of books and transmitted a lot of tradition, including these texts, right, that he's working off of here. And that, I think, is one of the many windows, right? What does it mean to be a creator and a transmitter of culture and tradition when you're yourself a deep skeptic of culture and tradition? So an amazing stance to occupy. So I wanted to share this with you because in some ways this is all the Maimonides we've seen, right? Is, you know, he's skeptical of people around him. He's skeptical of the possibility of widespread cultural change. He thinks that to be a, you know, authentic spiritual human being, you have to be deeply lonely. That all is familiar, right? None of the kind of conceptual work is new. But the way that he does it is so beautiful here, right? The way he takes this third account of Levitical election and centers it through this Midrash, brings in Kohelet, right? This wisdom literature about a lonely person who's alienated, but also totally universal, and weaves them together and says, okay, we've been talking about Shemitah and Yovel. You know, these are not just for mitzvot in specific places for specific people, but they're actually supposed to instill in all of us a sense of landlessness, which is about, you know, what being a Levite is about, and in some sense of what being a human being is about, even if it's always going to be unpopular. And so I just wanted you to see, kind of see and feel it, because I think there's a way in which, you know, it's easy to overplay Maimonides as too much of an iconoclast and miss his power as a reader and a writer to create a beautiful new version of the tradition here. Does that make sense? And so I just wanted you to feel all that. And, you know, it's an interesting way of thinking about the Mishneh Torah. You know, people often like to talk about, is Maimonides of the Mishneh Torah different than Maimonides of the Guide? So I think, you know, in this picture, what I'm developing is, you know, well, the content is the same, but the form is different, if that makes sense. This is a more traditional way of saying all these radical things. If you listen very closely, you might be scandalized. You have to listen a little more closely than you do in the guide. Okay, ready for number two? This one is going to speak a little bit more directly to our passage. It's a very beautiful passage, right? He said, Moses, please show me your glory. Right, so now we're again, right after the golden calf, actually just the next chapter after what we saw before, Moses goes back up to meet God. And they have this moment, which is completely incomprehensible here. And Hashem answers, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim before you the name Hashem. You will hear it, and the grace that I grant and the compassion that I show. But God said, you cannot see my face, for a person may not see, really should say, cannot see me and live. And the Lord said, see, there's a place near me. Station yourself on the rock. As my presence passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock and shield you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you will see my back, but you shall not see my face. You know, the dot, I messed up there, the left to right format. This is very beautiful. Now, the idea of you cannot see my face, we mentioned this in the theology class early on, right? It doesn't say you cannot see my face. It doesn't say lo yirani ha'adam. It's not like God exists on a part of the electromagnetic spectrum that the human eye can't detect. It's not that God doesn't have, well, yes. Where is this compassionate God? You're right. Also jealous and angry and not forgiving. As all, maybe as all true lovers are. I don't want to commit to that theory of love here, but true lovers sometimes feel. Right? It says, Liar Aniha Dam Vachai. A person can't see me and live, which means you can see God, but it will kill you. Right? God actually has a physical form. And here it seems like God has a face and a back and a hand. So what's great about this passage for us is this passage is for Maimonides, like the verses saying that Jews should own chattel slaves from the neighboring nations is for me. It's like, this is like everything that's worst. this is like, he's like, God forbid people should take this passage seriously, or at least literally, or take it seriously by taking it literally. That would be horrible. It would destroy their souls, right? So what does he do with it? You know, so we saw him already, he makes fun of the people who believe it literally, that they believe in monsters. Flying creature passes in front of rocks and puts their hand as a back. Even that he thinks is idiotic. But what does he do with it, right? Right, we saw in Guide to Torah, he has to read the passage. So watch this. So scroll down now. Okay, what did Moses, our teacher, want to comprehend when he said, please show me your glory? He asked to know the truth of the existence of the Holy Blessed One to the extent that it would be known in his mind as one who knows a particular person whose face she saw and whose image has been engraved within one's mind. Thus, this person's identity is distinguished within one's mind from that of other people. So Ariana, when I saw her on Zoom the first time in this course, I said, I remembered her immediately from when we learned together at Hadar. Because when you see someone's face, it becomes engraved in their mind. And Ariana is a distinct human being, different from the other 7.8 billion people in the world. And it just becomes part of how you move through the world. Such a person exists. That's what Moses, the relationship Moses wanted to have with God. Similarly, Moses, our teacher, asked that the existence of the Holy Blessed One be distinguished in his mind from the existence of other entities to the extent that he would know the truth of God's existence as it is. Period. Right there, in the set of entities Moses knows in the world, that tree, that house, that person, that stone, that fish, there would also be God, right, in the lexicon of kind of the gallery of entities. The Blessed One replied that it is not within the potential of a living man of body and soul, it's the body's fault, to comprehend this matter in its entirety. The Blessed Holy One revealed to him matters which no other person had known before him, nor would ever know afterward, until he, Moses, was able to comprehend some of the truth of his or its existence. The Holy Blessed One to be distinguished in his mind from other entities, as a person is distinguished from other people when one sees her back and knows the structure of her body and how she is clothed. I would add maybe her gait also. This is alluded to by the verse, you shall see my back, but not see my face. So this Moses had and no one else had. So if you could turn off the screen share for just a second, Andrew. I always find this very, very haunting. So the first thing I want to say, which is not the heart and soul of what Maimonides is saying here as a reader, but is very, very important, is that Moses, the part of Moses' request that was granted and which no one before him or after ever had, was the idea of being able to distinguish God from the other entities of the world. Does that make sense? You see the sun, you see the moon, you see the street sign outside your house, you see the food on your plate, and you know of God as a distinct entity. Now, part of what this means is that not you, not I, no one else has ever had an experience other than Moses where they can say that was God. I heard God's voice. I saw God. I knew that this was God acting and not anything else. For all the rest of us, the only perception we have of God is mediated through the objects of the world, which is to say we have no perception of God. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, my mind just kind of slipped that in, right? I mean, this relates to some of the things we did early on in the theology class on Wednesdays. A soul enduring beyond embodiment would be capable of perceiving and fully understanding the divine. More so, yes, I think that's exactly. So how does he explain the prophets? Great. So the prophets were in states of altered consciousness, right? They were not cogent. When they had dreams, right, they experienced signs and visions. What, you know, you might think of as hallucinations. But they weren't in a waking state of you know, normal cognition when they experienced God. That makes sense. That's only Moses. So that itself is a remarkably austere theology, perhaps hallucinogenic, right? And this is like Jerusalem syndrome, and, you know, people don't know this. So, you know, on the order of 200 people a year Yeah, exactly. Around 200 people a year experience being some either prophets or Jesus in Jerusalem. One of my good friends from Hadar, his uncle, Pesach, is a psychiatrist in Jerusalem who sees about half of these people. And I talked to him a few years ago about what it's like. And he said, you know, every person who comes into my office, I hope that they're really a prophet. So it's never happened yet. But it's really, it's amazing. When do you see someone, do you rate? Okay, so now for Ariana and Florence are getting there. Right? So Ariana is exactly right. We're seeing Maimonides do the work here. How does he read this? So what he does is he gives you an account, right, of what it is to know someone and to see them, right? And you can see their face or you can see them from behind. And part of what's so poignant about this is when you can see them from behind, you may know with just as high a degree of certainty who it is based on their height and their gait. I know that coat. I had a friend, one of my best friends in college, Nathan, he had a coat that no one else had. So when you saw that coat, you know, two blocks ahead of you on Cambridge, Mass Ave, you know it was Nathan. It's nothing like seeing Nathan's face. You hear, you know, from the way someone walks into a room, by the way, the creaks on the floor, you know it's them. It's nothing like making eye contact with them. And what Maimonides is doing here, and part of why I think this is so great, is he's not just saying like, oh, there's this passage I have to deal with, right? He's actually like helping us slow down and think about a term the philosophers would use is the phenomenology, the basic human experiences of encounter and of partiality. You know, and I would say on Zoom, right, I can see each of your faces. And for those of you who have your video on. But I know that that's still not sitting in the room with you. You know, the way you breathe, right? How you move your bodies, right? Or lean closer and further, right? Like just to experience those degrees of partialness. And my mind, I always think back to, I find this to be one of the most moving depictions of human encounter in the Jewish tradition. And we owe that to Maimonides, and I think he was compelled on some level to write it. So in the end of chapter 2 of Tanit Eliyahu, there is a mashal, a parable. And it's going to take a bunch of our time. We may not get to the last verse, but that's okay. The last verse is kind of a dark down one to end on. First, let me say something that's more thematically connected. There's a beautiful Amichai poem on the same. And the image, actually, he thinks that Moses saw God's face at the burning bush. I don't know exactly where he gets that idea from. I mean, there's a midrash that he's thinking of from Rabbi Yochanan. But the picture Amichai develops is that there is this, it's a clasterone, which is not quite a police sketch. There's a term for it in English. But apparently one of the ways of doing police sketches, like when they ask witnesses, what did you see, is not that they have the sketch artist that might have seen from, you know, different movies, but there are a whole set of different eyes. And the person says, oh, their eyes look like this. And then there's a set of eyebrows. And they say their eyebrows look like this, a set of noses. Their nose looks like this. And they put a composite face together. I don't remember the name of the Amichai poem, but if you Google Amichai, Moses saw face of God, identikit, bam. So what they say, what Amichai imagines is that Moses saw God's face once, burning bush. And out in the desert, he missed God so much, he put together an identikit image of God's face and passed it around to the Israelites and every tribe they encountered and said, have you seen this person? And no one had, right? In search of the suspect. And then he saw God's face with the divine kiss that took his life. And so on, I bumps now. I think it was Rabbi Sharon Cohen Anisfeld, president of Hebrew College, who taught me that poem. It's a beautiful poem. I don't know whether Amichai was thinking about this passage in the Rama. I don't know whether he knew this passage in the Rama, but it's a similar sense, right? He captures the ethos. And so I wanted to share that, just because that's the way that Maimonides operates. So again, you know, in some ways, there's nothing new that we've seen here conceptually, just like we saw about the Levites. But it's such a beautiful reading of the tradition, right? Of making something. Right, of using it as a way to think about human life. and give language to it. And I often think about something I learned at Chancellor Eisen's inauguration. I don't remember who said it. I actually should ask him. I've been emailing with him over the last couple of weeks. Thank you, Shoshana, for sharing that. One of the panelists said, you know, there were these organizations called Atheists for Reinhold Niebuhr and Atheists for MLK in the 60s. And they weren't fans of Niebuhr and Kay because Niebuhr and King, because they gave new interpretations of Christianity. You know, they were atheists by definition. They didn't care about Christianity. They were fans of Niebuhr and King because Niebuhr and King used Christianity to give them new interpretations of what it meant to be a human and an American. And this person said, you know, I think that's the work of Judaism in the tradition. And I just saw it on my shelf up here. That's basically what, here we go. I mentioned this. Peter Berger says we should do in the Heretical Imperative, which is a lovely, you can see it's a very thin book. It's a great book. And that's what Maimonides is doing in these two passages, right? That we saw he's giving us I don't want to say he's using the Torah, but from the Torah, he is fashioning a picture of what it means to be a human being in the ways that that's beautiful, in the ways that it's challenging, in the ways that it's poignant, in the ways that it's hard. So the Mashal goes like this, the parable. It's a parable of a king who had two servants. I'm not sure many of you might know this. And this is quoted, by the way, Abraham Joshua Heschel quotes it in this opening of the second volume of Torah HaShemayim. And Louis Jacobs also quotes it in one of his books, maybe The Introduction to a Jewish Theology. But I think they both leave something on the table, which I'm going to try to articulate. And I think this is Maimonides' wavering, but it's definitely mine, okay? So the parable of a king who had two servants whom he loved. And he gave them both a bushel of wheat and a bundle of flax. And he left. No instructions. So the first servant, wow, these are irreplaceable gifts from the king. And so he worked. I'm embellishing this a little bit, I tell it, but that's the only way to tell a story. He worked very hard to conserve them, to make sure that, you know, they were protected from sunlight and pests. And more exactly as they were given to. And the second servant said, this is an irreplaceable gift from the king. Took the flax and he spun it into yarn and he dyed it and he wove it into a fabric. And then he took the wheat and he grinded it and he winnowed it. He winnowed it first and then grinded it and then sifted it and then kneaded it and baked it into bread. And he covered it with the cloth. And the king came back, and he said to both of his servants, bring back to me what I gave you. And the first servant brought back the bushel of wheat and the bundle of flax. And the Midrash, the narrator, cheats here and says, what great humiliation, what great shame. The second servant brought a beautifully wrapped loaf of bread, which the king shared for a meal. The story ends, and Midrash concludes, so too the Torah was given to Israel as flax from which to make garments and wheat from which to make bread. This is amazing for a lot of reasons. The first thing I want to point out is, right, when the king leaves without instructions, there is no methodology for his servants to agree on what to do. And so the expectation is until and unless the king comes back, i.e. now, before the Messianic era, we Jews will disagree about how to relate to the Torah. And we will take different approaches, not just we will disagree, we will think that the other Jews are doing something sacrilegious and they the same of us. And that's just how it's going to be. So it's pluralistic in that sense. It doesn't think there's much hope of dialogue between those. It raises interesting questions. Where did each servant get their impression of the king? That's the first thing. You know, so the second thing I want to point out is the first servant is tragic, right? He has very sincere religious convictions and he works very hard and he wastes his life because he's doing something that's actually of no value. And that is really sad and also very noble. And those are the stakes, right? And I often think of this, Midrash, as like liberal theology goes on the attack. Because it's like, look, I know you're working very hard to keep Judaism just the same as it was. And I want to tell you, you're wasting your life. And God thinks that too. I mean, it's really devastating, but it might be right. But then things get really interesting because those lists that I described, the making into thread and dyeing and weaving, and then the winnowing, sifting, grinding, right? Those are the lists from Shabbat, Mishnah Shabbat. Well, the Melachot one's not supposed to be. And they're striking, right? They're transformations. The world doesn't get, one is more striking than the other. What I mean by that is the making of the flax into a garment, right? Once you dye it, there's no do-overs. What if the king doesn't like your taste? Well, you made it purple. King doesn't like purple. Bad move. So that's already a lot. But then think about the bread baking, right? When you sift it, when you winnow it, you take something out from what was given. See, this isn't nourishing. This isn't tasty. And when you knead it, I baked a lot of sourdough during that pandemic, right? You add in, there's ambient yeast, there's water, a little bit of salt. You say, for this thing that I was given by the king to be nourishing, to reach its full potential, it needs something else that wasn't there, right? Some of what was here needs to be removed and something that wasn't here needs to be added. And this is exactly what Spinoza complains about Maimonides doing, right? He says, you're bringing truth in from the outside and you're taking out stuff that was in there. And Maimonides says, exactly. Because Spinoza has a theory of interpretation where what you create, the interpretation is a picture, is a reflection of what is. But you would never say, is the bread shot on the wheat? Is the bread an accurate interpretation of the wheat? I don't know. Is sourdough a more accurate of interpretation of wheat than brioche or a pumpernickel or a bagel? You can make a lot of things out of it. And I like that bakery sourdough and you don't. You think it's too acidic, whatever. Like, I like it that way. We have different tastes and there's no one to adjudicate between us. And in some ways, the most elegant thing that this midrash does is, it's a midrash about non-literal reading, right? I hope that's clear. And it itself has a moment of non-literal reading in it because the king says, bring to me what I gave you, which is exactly what the first servant did. But that's not what the king meant. Right? The king said, bring me what I gave you, but the king didn't mean bring to me what I gave you. The king meant something like, bring to me the life-giving thing that you've created out of what I gave you. And so one of the ways I think about this kind of methodologically is there's two ways to run afoul of this, right? One we've talked about, where you create something that's life-giving, or you don't even create anything. You just pass it on as an inert object. You think the Torah is a test, not a gift. But there's another way where you bring the king a brisket. I gave you flour, right? You have to create something that you couldn't have created without the gift. You know, I'll just share, right? I grew up in a Reform synagogue. One of my friends kind of also ex-Reform, complicated Reform identity. So, you know, isn't it funny that Parshat Truma is about gun control and Parshat Mishpatim is about, reproductive justice. And, Parshat Lech Lecha is about, redistributive income taxes. You know, and it turns out every Parsha is about something in the Democratic Party platform, right? That you have failed, I want to suggest, to create, unless you do something really amazing with each one. You're just, okay, we know what the conclusion is. It's not interesting. You didn't make something that you couldn't have had without the Torah. Right. And so the task, according to the Midrash, is to create something life-giving out of the Torah, with the Torah. And that's what I want to suggest the guide is. And that's these two passages we just read from the Rambam, the whole work. And to be alive that certain things people would do with the Torah are, and this is great. My money says, right, from inside the sources of the Torah, I can't prove that you're wrong. I can't prove to you that this wheat needs to become bread. According to your, maybe God has a body, and maybe we ought to keep slaves. But I know that's wrong. And I'm going to make something different out of it. And what's the relation between the individual and what they create versus the community, what binds us together? So I actually, I skipped the intro to the Midrash, which I'll share in an attempt to answer this question. A heretic comes and asks Elijah the prophet. Good. It's the end, I'll put it in the chat. It's the end of Tana Debe Eliyahu, chapter 2. And by the way, what Heschel, neither Heschel nor Jacob says is the thing I said about the the work step being about taking things out and adding things in. That's my, I think, my Kaddish. Although if one of them says it, you can find it great. Jacob Petachowski, the great reform theologian of the 20th century, also has a book called Bread Not Stone, where he uses the punchline of this midrash, but I think there's a, he doesn't make the best bread. So the intro to the midrash is a certain heretic approaches Elijah and says, what's the difference between oral and written Torah? Aren't they both from the mouth of the Almighty? And then Elijah tells him this parable, which is not actually 100% clear how this answers the question. But what I want to suggest is that the oral Torah is the wheat. I mean, that's what it seems like. We're given at Sinai. And the written Torah, the written Torah is the wheat. And the oral Torah is the methodology of making something out of it. And we share those two things, right? Even though we make different things out of them. And we can and will always disagree. You know, I et cetera. Guys, it's time to wrap up. We're at the end of our time. As you can tell, I would love to go on. But I hope we've lived up to this midrash and up to the Rambam's call of making something life-giving out of, you know, the Torah of the five books, the Torah of Chazal, the Torah of the Rambam. And I hope that what this, you know, gives you a sense of, I guess, two things. One is a desire to read, you know, in a very broad way. I mean, this way, right? With like this full on integrity and all the problems and coming up against those moments when the Torah doesn't seem to be life giving and, you know, and to daven, right? Like we read, like, Gali nai vebitani float, the Torah tech, open up my eyes, but I see wonders in the Torah. So to read that way and to read others, read Maimonides, read them, you know, Midrash, Chazal, contemporary people that way. You know, and then the other is in some very broad sense to write, to do this yourself when you come across the places where, based on the things you know to be true, the Torah isn't life-giving and is saying things that are destroying our souls. You know, to speak up and to find ways, like we saw today, of reading, and because he's a writer here in these passages, and to share that Torah. And I hope you'll share it with me as well. I so appreciate the chats that are coming in. They mean the world to me. And you've been just a tremendous group across distance and space. And I want to just express my gratitude. Invitation the next time you're in New Haven, give me a ring. Love to have you over. So take good care. Easy, meaningful fast. People are fasting, but most importantly, hope you really experience a very deep Torah and life, and most importantly, perhaps the interrelation of those two.